Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It is Monday, December 22nd. The new year is just around the corner, and law enforcement is worried about what part illegal aerial fireworks may play in the revelry, as we are coming up on the one-year anniversary of a deadly fireworks explosion in an Oahu neighborhood. We hear from the new director at the State Law Enforcement Department, Mike Lambert. Kamehameha Schools is selecting a new trustee. We check in on the process. And we hear about an immigration hotline set up recently in response to the Trump administration's crackdown. Plus, 'tis the season of giving. We talk to the new head of the White Community Foundation about navigating another year of funding uncertainty for the nonprofit serving families throughout our island communities. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Got illegal fireworks? Be warned. After last year's tragic fireworks explosion in the Salt Lake Aliamano area, there are tougher laws, and public safety is top of mind for state officials. Joining us live this morning is Mike Lambert, who has taken over as the State Director of Law Enforcement. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, you know, I'm just hoping, you know, with the fatalities that we had and the scores of people that were injured in that neighborhood blast, that it's going to change behavior, but I'm worried it may not.
You know, it's going to take some time to change behavior. We're really hoping that at least a handful of families that participated last year or previously saw the devastation that happened to that family and are going to say, you know what, this year we're not going to roll that dice.
Yeah, I mean, just this weekend, you know, and I had no idea because we had booked you last week. We had a big explosion on Saturday, and then last night it was pew, 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 you know, and it's just like, I don't know if my neighbors think that, oh, time to blow them up now because people are going to be feeling the heat come New Year's Eve, but my tolerance level is just not there anymore.
Yeah, it's not, and I'm glad to hear you say that because I'm hoping that that's how a lot of people feel because really when you're changing something that people will say culture, which I disagree with, maybe tradition, because you can have any tradition that you want, but when people think that it's okay or when they think that nobody cares, and that's when it perpetuates. So we're really hoping that people are on our side and said, you know, it's annoying, it's dangerous, and this community's kind of over it. So I think that we're actually already out. We've actually been going out week after week. So what we want to ask everybody to do is to go on our website, law.hawaii.gov, and there's a tip line, and you can stay anonymous, even though it says report, whatnot. What we're asking people to do, if you know your neighbors have historically popped, then go ahead and give us that address. And what we're going to do is we're actually trying to look at how we're going to kind of move our way through the county New Year's Eve.
Right, because you want to let people know, you know, we got eyes on you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I don't think that we've been bashful. We've been on just about every media outlet that we could think of, and we appreciate this opportunity as well for these listeners. It's going to be stiffer penalties. If we do catch you, we're not going to just drive by. And a lot of the people are saying, yeah, whatever, or what about traffic fatalities? What about all this stuff? We haven't forgotten about those, but what we're trying to do is bring awareness to this issue because now it's front of mind.
Yes, and you know, you were previously with the Honolulu Police Department. We know that, you know, there are partners in all of this, and then you know, we can't forget our first responders, our firefighters, and our emergency medical personnel that are out there, you know, responding to these disasters.
Absolutely, and I think what everybody forgets is that, you know, it is our job as a police department to make sure everyone's safe. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it aligns with what you find is fun. So, you know, when we say don't do fireworks, don't speed, don't do this, it's really in public, the best interest of public safety. And I can tell everybody at home that we're no different first responders. We would like to be home New Year's Eve too. But because of these traditions that we have with fireworks, basically, I would assume fire department's going to be 100% staffed, EMS, and all law enforcement will be out that evening.
I just know my experience, you know, we had so much of these illegal aerials raining down on our rooftop, and thank heavens I have a metal roof, but it's spooky.
Yeah, it's annoying. You know, a lot of the people, you know, they don't realize that, yeah, okay, what's the big deal? until their house burns down. And then they're mad. Oh, where were the cops? Why did nobody do it? How does it get into the port? And all these questions get raised. So, you know, instead of waiting for these tragedies to happen year after year, law enforcement across the state has been much more proactive, has done a lot more messaging. And really what I'm hoping for is of 10 families that used to participate historically, that maybe one or two don't this year. And then the other 8 or 9, it's up to us as a law enforcement community to give citations, make arrests if appropriate. And year over year, those 10 families that, you know, popped on in last year, hopefully over the course of 4 or 5 years, maybe it's half that many.
Well, we have to stop it from coming in. Can you share any information that you have about any of the bus that you've made at the harbors?
Yeah, so we've actually been getting really good at it. A lot of it is building trust with the shippers to know that if we give them those tips that we're going to do something with it. So year to date, what we have actually total calculated is over 40 tons. And then we actually have what is likely to be another 20 tons uncounted, because we just caught a huge influx of containers that came in recently. So we have to get official weights. But like I said, we're good for 40 tons so far, which is a lot. I know some people are going to say, oh, that's tip of the iceberg and that's manini. But, you know, when you're dealing with an issue, you got to start somewhere. And I can tell you right now, if it does end up being close to 60 tons, that's a lot of fireworks that won't be in the neighborhoods this year. We're going to have to try to do our best to indict those individuals, because there's only so many people doing it. So year over year, if we can indict 2 or 3 of these shippers, then again, 4 or 5 years down the road, you know, it's only the very hardcore. And some of the things that we want to let people know, that we're dealing with organized crime, so they're not foolish. Right? I mean, they have lawyers, they're trying to find loopholes, and it's just a matter of law enforcement staying ahead of what they're doing.
And, you know, I was really grateful that when you folks did hold those buybacks, that people did bring in their illegals.
Yeah, I was grateful for that. It does show a change in sentiment. And again, it was anonymous. We didn't take names, but we were just trying to interview people and say, you know, what was it? And it was everything from the new law to the Aliamanu. And when it came to the Aliamanu, like a lot of it was kupunas to say, well, I don't want that happening at my house. I don't want that happening to my family. And then all the across the board to, you know, I've lived 60, 70 years without being arrested. I don't want to start this year. So I said, we jokingly told them, good move, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I did talk to a importer, you know, who said that he was aware that, you know, with all the talk about tariffs, right? I mean, these fireworks come from Asia. They come from China. And they were concerned about the tariffs. But they apparently had asked for a waiver during the first Trump administration. They got it. However, he said they have asked again. They have not yet heard back. And, you know, there's some speculation as to, you know, why not. And, you know, I know next year, though, is the birthday celebration of the founding of this country. And, you know, imagine that's going to be a big show. Because normally here in Hawaii, 4th of July is not that big. New Year's more is the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we know that predominantly it's New Year's Eve, but we are anticipating the 250th anniversary to be a big deal. And a lot of times, this is be real, people just want an excuse to let them off, right? So, I mean, whether it be a football game or whatever, or, you know, we saw on social media, you know, when Campbell won, you know, it's sad they were in the streets doing what they do. And, you know, they kind of put themselves on the radar for New Year's Eve because of it. You know, we're definitely going to be out in Neva Beach. And I'm really telling everybody, and I'm not trying to be a jerk or be a punk about it, but I really don't want anybody, I don't want to hear any crying about it, right? You know, when we give the tickets, or depending on what we see, if you get arrested, I mean, like, I don't know what else to tell you. Like, don't act surprised.
Yeah. Well, you live on the west side, and you know, it can be kind of crazy. And I've been out covering, oh my gosh, New Year's Eve. I know Kalihi Valley gets kind of crazy as well. So they're just these pockets, and they're usually the same suspects, right?
It is. And even for me, right, you know, now that I live in Hoapili, right on the outside of Neva Beach, and slowly it's been creeping, you know. Of course, it has been pretty quiet, but I'm starting to hear the explosions go off. But what I do notice is far less than years past. So that's encouraging. And again, I'm not delusional. People are going to let off. The difference is this year, we're going to have a more appropriate response. So I think in years past, when I was with HPD, we only gave out a few dozen, which I think what happened is it kind of sent the message that it's like pseudo legal, right? Because people are like, it's one of those laws they don't enforce. So the law enforcement community, we have to own that. We have to own that for the last 20, 30 years, we didn't prioritize it, which led to the belief that it's okay. To turn back the clock, now we have to work twice as hard, use twice as many resources to change people's mind and to reinforce the fact that there was a point in time where it was not a priority, but that time has changed.
Well, you know, you're a parent. I'm a new grandparent. And, you know, there was a 3-year-old child that died in last year's tragedy, you know, and so many of our kupuna. And, you know, this is in a neighborhood. And then so many children got injured. I mean, when we talked to our first responders, just the scene upon which they had to deal with that night, it was just terrible.
It is terrible. And the people that responded, yeah, everybody says looked like a war scene or looked like a bomb, it's terrible. But if you think about it, right, and not to turn off any of the viewers, but we have to have real conversation. That 3-year-old burned to death. You know, it wasn't like he got knocked out. I mean, no matter what, it would have been lost. But just to know that the baby burned to death, which is probably one of the most excruciating ways a human being can die. And then for people to be like, oh, one in a million. You know, it upsets me because I'm thinking like, Jesus, you know, what is it going to take? You know, how many families have to be short this Christmas? How many people have to walk around with, you know, burns to their body that you can never fix before people say, you know what, maybe we should switch the way we party? And I've been kind of telling people at the smaller community groups, I said, you know, let's find a new way to celebrate, right? We've built up in our mind that it's fireworks, but Hawaii has such great traditions of music and other things. And I jokingly said, and I don't know how long I can hold it, but I could say, I guarantee you for the near future, if you guys are playing live music and you don't sound terrible, we'll let it run till 12:15, okay. You know, instead of fireworks, right?
Yeah. Well, is there anything you want to share with our listeners? Because people are probably wondering with this anniversary coming up, you know, and they're thinking about the pain of these families. But what about law enforcement? What about prosecution?
So we're going to be out there. It goes all the way up to a felony. So if you recklessly light and it creates serious bodily injury or death, you're going to be facing an a felony. If it creates substantial bodily injury, so, and that doesn't really take much, you know, basically a huge laceration on someone, it's a B felony. And I really do believe that all the way through the judiciary, they're going to make examples of people that are making decisions that harm others.
And so, yeah, as far as in any active investigations or prosecutions from, you know, last year's tragedy, is there anything you can say?
I can't share. I wasn't privy to it. Honolulu Police Department is managing it. But I do know the prosecutor's office are still working those cases, and I would imagine that they're going to try to throw the book at them.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Anything you want to say to try and reach these people that may be planning to set off these fireworks, just to appeal to their senses to don't do it?
You know, all I can really say is that if you're okay with somebody not being there next year in your family because you want to have fun, I really don't know what to tell you. You need to reassess how you're looking at it. For me as a father, I can guarantee for the most part that it won't happen if I don't participate.
Yeah, so hopefully people will come to their senses and rethink. And will there be a buyback soon again, you think?
We might do one after the new year, but we're really thinking that at this point, it's going to be enforcement-based.
Okay, all right. So people need to be warned. Don't do it.
Don't
pay
do
the
it.
Consequences. Thank you so much, Mike Lambert. We really appreciate you coming down here today.
Mahalo. Thank you.
We've been hearing from State Law Enforcement Director Mike Lambert as we head into the New Year celebrations following the deaths of 6 people and scores of injuries due to an illegal fireworks explosion in an Oahu neighborhood.
In the new year, you can look to Hawaii Public Radio to bring you stories that impact the people of Hawaii and beyond, including coverage of issues that matter to all of us, like affordability, climate, and culture and the arts. Your financial support makes this work possible. Set up or increase your monthly donation, and let's go forward together. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
Kamehameha Schools is in the process of selecting a new trustee, just as the school faces legal challenges about its admission policy. Here to talk about this is HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Good morning, Cassie.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, and so I understand that there was a public forum, so the general public got to hear from these three candidates.
Yeah, that was like for the first time the public got to hear from these three candidates, and it happened last week, December 18th at Kamehameha Schools Kapalama campus. It was also live streamed too. So if people missed it and they still want to hear from the candidates, they can go on YouTube and just type in Kamehameha Schools trustee finalists and it will pop up and it's still archived. It's about maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours of the segment. Mm-hmm. That public forum was actually organized by the Oahu Council of the Association of Hawaiian Civic Clubs. That's a Native Hawaiian organization, along with Kanai Okana, who did the research and published the candidates' bios with whatever is available online.
Okay, so who's in the running?
It's actually three people. So we have Eric Yeaman, who is the chairman of Alexander and Baldwin. We have Keith Vieira, who's a longtime hotel and tourism executive, and Olin Kealoha Lagon, a social entrepreneur and the co-founder of Purple Maya. Mm. Actually, that was something that I didn't know. And people I've interviewed said a good candidate must have the knowledge in business, financing, and land management. And keep in mind, the searches for the trustees comes at a time where there's a legal challenge to the Kamehameha Schools admissions policy giving preference to Native Hawaiians and the ongoing effects of the Maui wildfire settlement. Whoever gets that top job, you know, they got a big job on their hands, and the trustees, they're responsible for overseeing assets worth about $15.2 billion. And the trust owns more than 300,000 acres of land across the state, making them one of the largest landowners here in Hawaii. And the trust was created by Princess Bernice Puahi Bishop in 1883 for the education of Native Hawaiians. And, you know, with this announcement of the finalists coming out December 31st, the public comment period closes December 31st. That's not enough time that people have said to meet the finalists and get to know them. And some beneficiaries and alumni say, you know, they're worried about that. Here's council member Esther Kia Aina of Honolulu, who's been a longtime critic of the process.
I have to question the consultants who put out the advertisement for comments because they seem to have gotten it out late. The deadline is December 31st and it's the holiday seasons. So how is that fair? Also, why is it that we have to go and look up their qualifications? So I just think all the way around, we need to collectively determine how we could work for changing the whole selection process. And quite frankly, I'm actually now questioning the authority of the probate court to do so. In other words, what can we do to change up the whole process?
And for those who don't really know the process, it can be a confusing process. Under the current selection process, a court-appointed screening committee of seven people identifies and narrows down the finalists, and then there's a public comment period about 30 days before the probate court picks the top candidate. And the selected trustee will serve a 5-year term with the ability to seek one additional term thereafter. Before that, the process before, it was the Hawaii Supreme Court justices, about five justices in Puahi's will, who could fill vacancies on the board. That changed after the 1990 scandal that was documented in Broken Trust. And beneficiaries and stakeholders have long raised concerns that the selection process remains too close to this day and offers limited opportunities for alumni, faculty, and other community members to engage. But there has been push for change. But that effort stalled. A 2024 court ruling halted efforts to shift to a more transparent process, one that would give stakeholders a say. But right now that the public doesn't know who the members of the screening committee are or the process of recruiting trustees. So they're still pushing for change, but ultimately they want just the best trustee.
And then do we know, are they looking for anyone or any candidate with particular experience?
For the probate court, it's honestly up to them. I mean, right now we have a very diverse board right now. You have Noilani Goodyear with the education background. You have Rose, who has a legal background. There is someone on the current board of trustees that has a tourism background. It could be Keith, but it really is up to the probate court. I have heard from sources who I've interviewed that they are in favor of Olin, and Olin has an interesting background. He grew up in public housing. He's for pushing for more programs such as special education in Kamehameha schools. But, you know, he comes more from like a social entrepreneur background, something that the board doesn't have. But keep in mind, it is coming at a time with the admissions policy being challenged. So it's not so much as a popularity contest. So people may favor, let's say, Olin, for example, a little bit more than the others. But it's ultimately up to the probate court to make the final decision. I spoke with Julian Ako, who's a former principal at Kamehameha Schools Kapalama, and he says while he's not happy with the current selection process, his concern right now is getting the best trustee out of the three candidates, and he had this to say about the selection process.
I'm still not happy with what happens after the three court masters issued their report last year. There's a little bit more transparency, but not complete transparency in terms of how do the seven people who ended up on the screening committee end up being the people who were invited to so-called apply to be in the screening committee. You know, why those seven? Why was not there a public call that went out to invite anybody who might be interested in serving on the screening committee? So there's still a lack of transparency there. And then the process itself, the three court masters as well as the probate court judge rejected my call as well as that of some of my friends for, you know, a selection process that is driven and managed by stakeholders.
And so, as it stands, the only way for beneficiaries to participate is by submitting written comments. So, more than actually 50 people attended last week's public forum to engage, and they got to submit questions to the candidates on, you know, what their top priorities are going to be. But Ako said that he would have liked that the current candidates release their candidate statements.
You know, that they submitted as part of their, as well as their cover letter when they applied to be considered for a trustee. I think all three of them ought to make that information public. But, you know, that has not happened, you know, and even their biographies have not been publicly released. There's a network called Kanai Okana that apparently did some research on what was publicly available on all three candidates and produced some bios. But people shouldn't have to do that. I think that it's incumbent on all three finalists to step forward and say, this is who I am, this is my bio, and this is what I use to be considered to be interviewed as a finalist. It's very, very murky waters for me.
Yeah, but you still have those organizations like Kanai Okana who, you know, went ahead and published their backgrounds themselves for the public to easily access online. So the trustee finalists, they're going to have to balance a lot of things. They're going to have to balance like land management, but also sensitive cultural sites as well. And, you know, we have the upcoming public comment period ending on December 31st. So people are still writing their written comments.
Right. Because, yeah, the deadline's coming up fast.
Yep.
But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing from HPR's Cassie Ordonio. She's had details on the search process for a new trustee for Kamehameha Schools. You can track her coverage on this issue on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
received responses from across Europe, from the Danish Prime Minister.
Climate.
Picture this all filled with ice.
Security.
Not only do we need to end the war, we also need to prevent the next war.
These are global issues, and to understand them, you need a global perspective. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us for The World each and every weekday.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Today on The Daily, the construction of a massive factory in Arizona provided companies around the world with literally 18,000 reasons to think twice about building in America. I'm Mike Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Concern is growing over what's estimated to be dozens of immigrants held at the Honolulu Federal Detention Center. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency has for the last 6 months been transferring immigrants who were detained on the continental U.S. to the Oahu facility next to the airport. Once it became clear that the Trump administration was pursuing an aggressive immigration policy, the Refugee and Immigration Law Clinic at the University of Hawaii set up a deportation defense hotline. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with two attorneys with the clinic to get an update on their efforts. Esther Yu is the director of the clinic, and Pilar Cam is an immigrant advocate and postgraduate fellow. Cam starts us off with information about the hotline.
So when I was a student, I volunteered for the clinic prior to working for it. And what I can tell you is that back then there was not even a need for a hotline because there wasn't this effort to just catch people. When President Trump took office and he started coming up with these quotas, like asking that ICE and DHS put as many people in detention as possible. And that put a lot of pressure on those agencies to do that. And that may be one of the reasons why we're seeing what we're seeing is just that pressure of increasing the numbers of detainees, of immigrant detainees in detention centers. And it all happened very, very fast. We started seeing almost immediately after that executive order, the detention started happening, the arrest started happening. And all of a sudden, we had this flood of phone calls of people not really knowing what to do. So we set up the hotline, and now it has become a source for people to look for information and find their detained loved ones. Unfortunately, what happens when a person gets detained is that they are stripped of all of their belongings, and that includes their phone numbers. And ask me if I have memorized the phone number in the past decade. I don't think so. And neither has most people. So once they don't have their phones and things like that, they're completely disconnected from the outside world. That coupled with the fact that when they're transported to the detention center and they go through the process of being registered, they have to assign them a certain numbers for them to be able to access the outside world, to receive funds from the outside, for them to buy minutes to call on the phone and things like that. And that takes time. At the beginning, it took a couple of days. Now it's taking like 2 weeks, and it is bound to like get worse because there's so many people that they're processing in. All of the processes are slowing down. So a lot of times when we hear that someone has been detained, the person who calls is maybe a loved one, a coworker, or someone of the public who was there and happened to know the person. And then with a name, we manage to find where that person is located. Normally, the person detained is assigned a number, and with that number, we can request permission to go and visit the person. In the early months, we were able to just show up at the Federal Detention Center and do our visits. We knew, you know, we have so many people. These are their inmate numbers. Can we visit? Now we actually have to be pre-approved to go and visit. So it just seems like there is also an escalation, the difficulty into reaching these people. And it goes in waves. The way the agencies work, I'm sure they have their schedules and they go visit in our state, for instance, they go to one island or the next, or and they visit at certain areas, and then sometimes they do a raid and they end up detaining 5 people, 10 people. Sometimes it's a very large number, like 40, 50. And they are all transported to Oahu and brought to the FDC. And so then we start the process of trying to find them. And in the meantime, we're getting this inflow of calls, of people calling. What we do is we try to provide them information on how to find their loved ones to start. If they can visit, you know, what are the steps that they need to take to go and visit their loved ones, how to help them with putting money in their account so that they can call out, that sort of thing. And then we provide the service of going to the FDC, having a conversation with them, see, try to figure out what their actual immigration situation is, because it's a very broad spectrum. I would say a large majority have something going, some kind of asylum application or something that is pending, but they still find themselves in detention. And once we have an idea of what's going on with them, we try to figure out what's the best way to help them in that process. That's where we find ourselves at right now.
Going back to the change in policy of having to be on the approved list and needing the unique ID to talk to a person who's been detained, what's the official reason that's been given for those changes?
They're not required to explain. They just implement them and we just have to follow the rules. I'm sure they have their internal processes and whatnot, but nothing is explained to us. All we know is we get a directive just letting us know this change is being implemented, and unless we follow it, we're not going to be able to go in. So we have no choice but to comply.
And how do you decide who to represent?
So I just want to mention that ICE officially says that in Hawaii they've arrested about 150 people and detained them. Our hotline has actually received about 150 calls. We don't think that we've gotten, obviously, calls from 100% of the detainees, so we think that the official statistics are undercounting some folks. In terms of the cases that we take, so we're operating the hotline, but we're mostly acting as a service to make sure that each person who's detained knows their rights and what to expect in the process. We screen them for immigration relief. So we have a conversation with them, try to figure out their immigration situation. If they ask us or request, you know, a referral, we have a network of immigration attorneys that we know, you know, do detained cases in immigration court, and we will refer them to one of those immigration attorneys. But no, yeah, we cannot, our clinic, especially because I'm teaching law students, you know, we can't take 150 cases, full representation. But yeah, I think our service is mostly useful, as Pilar described, in for an outsider, someone who's not an immigration lawyer, not familiar with the processes and how the system works, right? If they see their loved one getting arrested, and especially with the news these days about people being immediately transferred to like Louisiana or being sent to Uganda, right? Suddenly, there are a lot of people for whom that event is extremely stressful, right? And so the hotline is really there to provide almost like comfort, right? And real information, accurate information, instead of, you know, what you might get, you know, looking at Facebook or, Instagram, right? Which is full of misinformation. And so, yeah, Pilar and Stephanie have done an amazing service, I think, to this community in providing, you know, that kind of accurate information that and guiding, you know, these families through a very, very difficult time, you know, in their lives.
Esther, how has your philosophy to teaching immigration law been changed under this administration? And what do you tell law school students, people who are early on learning the law?
You know, I was joking with my students on the last day of class that I've never had a semester like this where I've had number one, so many new stories and developments that I need to share almost on a weekly basis, you know, updating my syllabus, adding new policy alerts. So it is a very difficult time right now to be an immigration lawyer. And obviously, number one, because of the changes that seemingly happen overnight and that surprise, you know, people in the middle of a case, right? It feels like, you know, the ground is just shifting right underneath your feet. And then, of course, for most immigration attorneys, you know, we don't go into this field to become rich. We do it because we care about immigrants and we want to help people. So it is very difficult, you know, to process the suffering and the hardships, right, that seem very unnecessary. So I do talk honestly with my students about this, but I still want to encourage them to consider immigration law because of the people, you know, that we help and how rewarding it is. We can't tell you how many like sweet, thoughtful, you know, comments that we've gotten from clients or people we visited in the detention center, just thanking us for not even helping them win their case, but just being there for them. Just and listening. I think, yeah, I think, you know, there's something about immigration law where you're put into that situation very often, and it's very rewarding. The other thing that I want to emphasize to my students is, you know, the reason I teach immigration law the way that I do is I want them to feel empowered that they can change the law. So the law as it is, honestly, it stinks. Like the immigration law, the process is horrible. There's a lot of ways that immigrants can make honest mistakes even and get deported. There's a lot of injustice in our current laws, but I want them to understand the system as it is. And I want them to feel like I can change it. You know, my generation, we can change this to make it, you know, a more just, more humane system. And so I still feel a lot of satisfaction at the end of every semester. You know, when I look at my students, I see that they are, despite all of the discouraging news, I feel like most of them do feel inspired and empowered by the knowledge that they've just gained during that semester. And I teach because honestly, like especially in these times, it's my students that are my lifeline to hope and to feeling like, okay, if I stay in this and I continue teaching the next generation of lawyers and policymakers, you know, we can see, you know, something better emerge from all of this.
That was Esther Yu and Pilar Kam of the UH Refugee and Immigration Law Clinic. They spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have more information about the hotline on our website after the show. This year, stories from the NPR archives that touch on the meaning of Christmas, our hopes, and our fears. David Sedaris, Bailey White, Scott Simon, these and other voices of NPR past and present telling stories of the season in an hour-long Christmas special. I'm Lynn Neary. Join me for Tinsel Tales from NPR.
Beginning Thursday morning at 11.
Celebrate the holidays with Truman Capote and James Thurber. We offer funny and touching stories from each of them on this special Selected Shorts. I'm Meg Wolitzer. Tune in from American Public Media.
Beginning Friday morning at 11.
George recently took over as head of the Hawaii Community Foundation. His 5 decades here in Hawaii and work in philanthropy have helped prepare him for the challenges around the uncertainty for so many of our nonprofits as we head into the new year. George has worked with several local philanthropic groups, most recently serving as president and CEO of the Castle Foundation. He started his career with the Ford Foundation and worked in India before settling back down in Hawaii. He stopped by our studio last week to talk about what's ahead.
I've luckily had a career with several philanthropies, including the Consuelo Foundation, doing a lot of work in self-help housing in Waianae and prevention of domestic violence and child abuse, and then leading the Harold Castle Foundation's work in public and higher education equity and in nearshore marine resource conservation. And through those times, I began to see how powerful the Hawaii Community Foundation was. And we were involved in my various other philanthropies in supporting initiatives that the Community Foundation had started. And then I was going to step back, let other leaders step up. But at the same time, Micah Kane, who has been a remarkable and effective leader of the Hawaii Community Foundation for so long, was invited to go lead Parker Ranch. And so I started getting asked, would you be willing to step up? And as you mentioned, Catherine, these are difficult times. Our social safety net has already been stretched close to the breaking point because of the fact that we really haven't grown our wage, our earned income base very much. And yet the cost of living has soared because we haven't built enough units of housing and other reasons. And then when the federal policy changes hit, that really put some holes in that social safety net and created a lot of uncertainty, which also creates a lot of philanthropic opportunity to step in when times are tough. And I think that's something that the Community Foundation has done in disasters and other tough times, Catherine.
Yes, Hawaii is just an incredibly generous community that in times of need, people step up.
They always do. And I think what we've learned is first communities step up without asking for permission. They're there the next day after the wildfires in Lahaina. They had already done the water brigade from Molokai, and just a lot of the longtime families, just even though they'd lost everything, they were there the next day figuring out how to feed and provide water to everybody and provide moral and physical support. And then you've got this sea of generous people that you mentioned, Catherine. We ended up having piles of envelopes on our tables at Hawaii Community Foundation within weeks of the wildfires, because the day afterwards, we launched the Maui Strong Fund. And so these generous people put in everything from kids' allowances to $1 million for somebody who wanted, and like $500. We're still getting donations. I got a donation from a college freshman who wanted to donate what little savings he had to help Maui still. And I just am floored all the time by that generosity. It's just wonderful.
I grew up in a community where resilience was key. Yeah. And when I moved here, I worried for this community because I thought, if you're used to being hit with super typhoons, that's one thing. But if you're not, and then you have something major and tragic, like the lava flows, you know, the Maui wildfires, you just worry that we may not be able to have the infrastructure to be able to move fast.
You're right. And yet we are resilient. So if we can first identify where the points of resilience are and connect them up between community, grassroots community groups, nonprofit organizations, local and state and federal government, we're going to be okay. But it's a long process to recover, and different disasters have different aspects to them. And so we've learned a lot from our work to respond to the lava flows, to the rain bomb on Kauai, for example, past hurricanes, from COVID, as well as the wildfires on Maui. And we're going to now move into what we call a Stronger Hawaii effort, which will be to get ahead and help communities that have that resilience build greater resilience and better connections ahead of the next disaster. So stay tuned to that as we build that out in future years. But we've learned a lot about what to do and how to think this through. And if you can get earlier understanding of where the most vulnerable communities are, say Kupuna, Keiki, people of lower income, people with disabilities, people with English language challenges, and if you build communications channels ahead of time with those who are primed and ready to help, we're likely to avoid some of the early chaos and make sure that resources get to those with greatest need early.
We hear a lot about food insecurity. Mm-hmm. And I recall a story where in Windward Oahu, they were trying to get more people to plant ulu trees.
Yes.
Because breadfruit, right? There are communities there that grew up with it. And if you can have it in your backyard and the roads are closed and you can't get supplies, it just helps them to be a lot stronger and more self-sustainable and resilient.
I agree with you. And it helps people have a sense of literally of grounding in place. And grounding in the Aina has been a wonderful development, I would say. There's been a significant growth of Aina-based organizations that are not only restoring, they're replanting things like ulu, but they're restoring fish ponds, they're restoring lo'i, they're restoring riparian areas along streams. They're taking out the bad plants, putting in the new ones, and they almost always have an educational component to them. So the Hawaii Community Foundation has been really honored to be part of that expansion and that movement. I think it also relates to the culture and language-based movement within education, not just in charter schools, but regular public schools as well. And when we can lift up and celebrate the deep indigenous knowledge that we have in Hawaii, then everybody is better off. When I went to school, we didn't have that ability to sort of understand that. There was only one class that I could take in my high school to study anything about Hawaiian history. I did not know that growing up in Hawaii Kai, that really was one of the most productive fish ponds in the entire Pacific region. And now there are ways to do that, and it's largely because of these nonprofit voluntary efforts that are regrounding us in history and a sense of reverence for place. We're going to need that reverence as climate change sort of shifts things in ever more profound ways for Hawaii. We can do it if we hold on to the values that we've always been able to rely on in order to take care of each other and be resilient, and we can use those same values with modern technology to step up and forge a better future in Hawaii.
And how do we balance the need to make sure that we're spending things properly and using best practices to roll the money out to where the need is, but then also to be able to have the flexibility and fewer restrictions mm-hmm. on the spending?
So we're kind of on a journey that way. And at the Hawaii Community Foundation, we have 1,000 different funds and then about 300 or so scholarship funds as well. And these are created in partnership with generous individuals who have passions about ways to make Hawaii better. And then we connect those people who care with causes that matter. And we have a team of expert staff who know what's happening on the ground, know how to combine investment in the nonprofit sector with also policy research, for example, by UHERO or by Holomua or the Hawaii Data Collaborative, and also in building partnerships with government. So you're essentially investing in both grassroots innovation, applied research, and policy innovation. When you do that, you can begin to move from piloting something innovative to something that really is scalable. And that takes time. So the more that we have dollars that are flexible and focused on impact and that can move with where the community is moving, de-risk innovation, spread it, we're better off. So that's part of the shift that we're seeing at Hawaii Community Foundation. And I can share some stories about that.
Yeah, because sometimes the red tape, while it's meant to make sure that we're accountable with how things should be spent and not open to corruption or whatever, but you do need the flexibility. Like we saw that with the pandemic.
You do. You do. Absolutely so. Sometimes what we need to do is trust the people closest to a problem. So I believe that the genius lies in communities, and particularly for people who've been longtime community leaders there who just exude aloha and determination. And I believe aloha is a muscle. It's not a feeling. It's really fundamental to taking care of our place and standing up when things need to change. I believe that when we can respond and listen to community first, make sure they have a place at the table, link those communities together in a network, make their work visible by sharing powerful stories about what they're doing and the nonprofits they're engaged with, and then making sure that bubbles up to policy, we're going to be better off.
And then I don't know what you're seeing or what you're hearing from nonprofits in the community that have, let's say, had their federal funding just yanked or paused, and then they're just scrambling to meet the need.
So I see profound challenge and resilience and determination at the same time, Catherine. We commissioned UHERO when we relaunched the Hawaii Resilience Fund, which was what we named our response to COVID. We sunsetted that and restarted it again to help get dollars aggregated and distributed out there to support the nonprofit sector. But the first thing we did was ask UHERO to do research on what's the extent of the cuts and the impact and the risk to our nonprofit sector. They immediately found in the summer $97 million of cuts and a risk of another $300 million. And part of it is the uncertainty. But the sectors that seem to have been affected the most have been the environmental sector, Native Hawaiian serving nonprofit organizations, those focused on education, on climate, and also the front-facing human services sector. And so we then gathered the sector and asked what they needed, and we provided direct support to a dozen nonprofits that are affected the most to give them flexible dollars, not just to continue their operations, but maybe to retool their business model so that they can survive through this period. We've also talked with and gently talked with people within state and government and the legislature. We just salute them for how they stepped up during the government shutdown and also the way that they passed a special emergency nonprofit support fund that provided $50 million to nonprofits, but that isn't enough. We need to do more. So we plan to expand this. And the next thing we're looking at, Catherine, is how to reach people who are on MedQuest or Medicaid early enough for them to know what the new work rules will be starting in January 2027 that are required to be documented so that they can remain on Medicaid as well as SNAP. Working first on listening and then co-designing with stakeholders, and then we hope to partner with other funders. We just convened a dozen funders just on Wednesday to really unpack this problem, what's the level of impact and where we're going. But the nonprofit sector is critically important to Hawaii, and just they're the ones who feed our families when we're hungry. They take care of our keiki. They bring hot meals to our kupuna. They provide after-school A-plus programs in public schools. They allow us to bring arts into public schools. They support creativity. They give us a sense of pride in our various cultures. They put the color in our world. So we need to recognize that and be there for them. And we're all determined to do that at Hawaii Community Foundation.
That was Terry George, the new head of the Hawaii Community Foundation, talking to us about the challenges ahead. That does it for us for this hour. Tomorrow marks the anniversary of the spectacular lava fountaining at Kilauea. We check in with scientists about this unusual phase. Have a story idea to share with us? Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.